Hey, parents, Greenlight is here to take one big thing off your to-do list, teaching your kids about money. With a Greenlight debit card and money app of their own, kids and teens learn to earn, save, and invest. You can send money instantly, set flexible controls, and get real-time notifications of your kids' money activity, set up chores, and put allowance on autopilot to reward them for their hard work. Then learn about the world of money together. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley. For the love of home.
MSW Media.
So, Renato, how has the trial been going for Trump so far?
It's complicated. I'm Renato Mariotti. I'm a former federal prosecutor, a practicing lawyer, and a legal analyst.
And I'm Asha Rangappa. I teach national security law at Yale University. I'm a former FBI special agent, and I'm a legal contributor for ABC News.
And we're here to help you understand topics that can't be boiled down into a soundbite or a tweet. So, Asha, we're here. This is the second day of trial when we're recording this. I think we should say that up front so people have their expectations set appropriately. But a lot's happened. We have a jury. We've had opening statements. That's a big moment in any trial. This morning we have our first witness, David Pecker, testifying. We'll talk about the gag order stuff a little later, but you know, what is your impression? How do you think about the trial thus far?
I mean, it's hard, right? Because we only have a transcript. And so I kind of wish that it were televised so that we could all see exactly how things are being presented. But I've just been paying attention to Trump having a meltdown.
Right. I mean, one thing that's been very interesting to me, Olivia Nuzzi, who I think she writes for, what is it, New York Magazine, if I recall correctly?
Yeah.
She has been giving like moment by moment tweets about every facial expression Trump has, every little thing she does. And she said, I thought this was really interesting. She said that she's been criticized for this from people who say that she's humanizing Trump. And her perspective as a journalist is, this is the former president's on trial. There's no cameras in the courtroom. I'm essentially recording history here and telling everyone what happens and people deserve to know. I agree 100% with that. I will just say, by the way, some of you in the YouTube comments were very upset with some of my comments in the last episode. Our point here is to do the same thing, is to talk about the issues and show you guys the truth, even if you don't like it one way or the other. And I think that what people hopefully are seeing here, and I'll say this from the perspective of somebody who has many clients who have been indicted, who have been gone to trial, who have dealt with the weight of this, is being a criminal defendant is really, really, really stressful. It is difficult. It is a huge burden. And Trump puts up a very good face over that and tries to act like he's all be above it all and he's not fazed by anything. But I think what we're starting to see here is, for those people who talk about accountability, there is a real measure of accountability here in terms of having to sit in this courtroom and be judged and really be on trial, trying to fight for everything here in this criminal trial. It's taking a toll on him.
Well, especially since he's not used to this kind of environment where he can't control the narrative. You know, he is very used to creating information vacuums this is what this whole trial is about, right? It's him suppressing information that's negative about him. And he creates vacuums about, you know, his medical health and his grades. And he's able to fill that with his preferred self-image. And he's not able to do that in the trial. He's not able to insult and put down people who are on the stand who are saying things that he doesn't want. He can't get up and walk away. Like, I think it's going to be a real challenge to his established defense mechanisms and coping strategies, which I think is going to add to what would be an ordinary stress on any defendant. Like, I think he has very fragile psychological defenses that are going to be dismantled in this whole process.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I think a separate issue for him is, I think, you know, he has been in a bit of a bubble, right, for probably his whole life, where he's got people waiting on him and catering to him. You know, if you're drinking 15 Diet Cokes a day, maybe you get a little tired in the courtroom, for example. Maybe you do get sleepy if you don't have your caffeine. You know, being in court, I'll just say this to somebody who's tried a lot of cases. It is a stressful experience for anybody. One of the challenging pieces of it is that you're always on all the time. So the jury is watching you all the time. If you're an attorney, and certainly if you're the defendant in a criminal trial, their eyes are on you. You are always putting on a show for the jury. And I always tell my clients, and I certainly told the agents when I used to work with them, and they would be sitting at counsel table when I was a prosecutor, that like they are watching everything we do, everything we say. And so it's just a lot for anybody. And for somebody like him, who's used to being able to sort of do what he wants and be in a bubble, I think that's definitely a challenge.
So let's start with the jury in terms of the jury that was selected. And also, I know that you have been tweeting a little bit about Trump's attitude towards the jury, which I don't know if it's changed. I know last week, at least when they were during voir dire, you were saying that there were reports that he wasn't standing when they came in. And I mean, I would interpret that as perhaps being contemptuous, and that's not really a great legal strategy.
That's right. So first of all, let's just talk about the composition of the jury for a second, because one thing that, since we're going to probably be talking about this for some time now, for some weeks, this trial, one thing I just want to say is there's a real wild card, in my view, that's been inserted into this jury, because there's two lawyers on it. So typically, juries have no lawyers on it. I don't like lawyers on my jury, and most lawyers don't want to put lawyers on the jury. Why? Because in most cases, you've got a bit of a wild card. Other jurors may just defer to the one lawyer on the jury and let that lawyer sort of tell them what the right answer should be. And then you basically, your entire jury of 12 people, let's say, ends up being one person. But secondly, they may try to outsmart everybody and look at things and see things that a typical person doesn't. So when I'm trying a case, typically I'm appealing to someone like my dad, who's a cashier at Walmart. I mean, that's how I am trying to put my case on, not to appeal to somebody who went to law school. But they've got two lawyers on there. I think that's very favorable to the defense in this case. And we'll get more into that later. But I think the Trump's team needs somebody to be very technical about how they look at some of the things in this case or from a defense perspective. And so I think one thing that's an interesting issue here, an interesting question that we're going to have to think about is, you know, the prosecution, I think, made a gamble by putting those people on the jury or letting those people get onto the jury. And I think, you know, we'll see whether that works out for them, right? It's a bold gamble, Cotton. Let's see if it works out for them. That meme is a bold move. I'm not sure that that's going to work out.
Yeah, I would actually argue the other way. I think that this is a bit of an abstract case. If you get beyond the actual false entries that are being made, this idea that there was a scheme going on and there's a lot of, you know, there's two transactions that are counting as part of the bad acts. And I don't know, I think that you could very well have jurors who otherwise would be like, well, I don't see the link between da 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 da. And, you know, you have a lawyer who's like, well, let me explain it to you. And could work out the actual logic that would get them to guilt. I don't know. I think it could cut both ways. I'm not entirely sure that it is helpful for the defense necessarily.
But see, I think that itself is the point. So here, one thing I'll just make sure our listeners understand. The prosecution always has the upper hand in a criminal trial. if they don't, what the heck were they doing charging the case? So they always pick cases that they think they're going to win. They always have the upper hand. They always have advantages. The jury assumes that the person's guilty. That's my experience. Okay. And I think most criminal defense attorneys would tell you that. So of course the prosecution is going to win. So anything that creates a wild card is bad for the prosecution. Like, in other words, the average person who knows nothing about the law, just, you know, whatever, they're a janitor, they work at 7-Eleven, whatever it might be, they go into that trial and they're going to hear all this stuff from the prosecution about how this is a scheme and a conspiracy and whatever, and opening statements. They're probably going to think this guy's guilty, and their eyes are going to glaze over the course of multiple weeks hearing all this testimony. But their takeaway is going to be like, this guy's shady. Trump's shady. Okay. Sounds like he's guilty. Like, anyone looking too much into the details, it's like, remember how in Clueless they were making, they would say, oh, she's a Monet, right? Because they're making like an impressionist painting where you see how an impressionist painting looks when you're up close, you see all the brush strokes. From a distance, it looks gorgeous. And the point is, I think the prosecution's case here on a surface level sounds amazing. There are issues with it. I'm not saying they're not going to get convictions, but there are issues with it when you dig into it, into the details. And I think there's a possibility the attorneys will do that. There's a possibility they won't. But I think it's an interesting wild card here. Another thing, by the way, Asha, I mean, there is somebody in the jury, I think, who does listen to Fox News. So there is a potential. I mean, Trump's team also could be mm-hmm. trying to get a hung jury. That I think would generally be considered a win from a defense perspective. And the reason I'm throwing this stuff out there is because the jury selection process will in many ways determine the outcome of the trial. We don't know what that's going to be. But to circle back to the point you made, I do think that one thing that, and hopefully people can get a sense of if they're listening to this, is that juries don't make decisions in entirely like rational ways. And one thing that'll piss people off is if the defendant is being disrespectful to them.
Yes, we're sleeping.
Indeed.
So let's talk about the opening arguments then.
Yes, opening statements, although they turn out to be arguments. I argue during my opening statements. If any judge is listening, I don't, you know, that is the truth.
So the DA's office paints this as an election interference case.
Correct.
Right. This was an attempt to dupe the voters. And I feel like we've disagreed about this before.
We have, about how accurate of a descriptor that is. I mean, they also use the term conspiracy. There's no charge here of conspiracy, but they use the term criminal conspiracy. I think that's the underlying crime. I mean, my problem with it, Asha, and so I think it works from hitting people in the gut perspective. And what I mean by that is when I try cases, I try to convince people in their gut, not in their head. And it's like, it sounds really bad and sinister. And they did a nice job of showing the jury why this case matters, why they should care, why they should convict. I think that's really important. But the issue for them is that he's not charged with all that stuff. He's charged with falsifying business records. And specifically then that, you know, with you doing that to conceal another crime, namely, appears election fraud. That is what the case is really about. And so I do think the defense is totally hamstrung by their client. We could talk about that as well. But they did do a better job in opening statements than I expected, by honing in on some issues that I think are going to really be the focus of the trial. Because I think all of the stuff about this grand scheme and grand conspiracy, if they're going to win on that, then no matter what the prosecution does, they're going to win. But I think that from the defense perspective, because it may very well be that just all 12 jurors are going to convict on that. But I think the defense is going to really focus on the elements and the jury instructions and try to get the jury to understand that actually the charges in this case are a little technical and there are some issues with the government's evidence.
Though they were also addressing the big theory, right? Because the defense argued, yeah, so what if they were trying to influence the election? That's democracy. That's just how democracy works. I don't know that that's smart. And I mean, just because you know, if like if they're engaging in that narrative, I mean, first of all, it's not democracy when you're like hiding stuff. Like that's like the opposite of informed voters. And I feel like they're opening the door for the prosecution to really drive home that point that, you know, democracy entails transparency and accountability. And it's, yeah, if you're on the up and up, I mean, if you declare to the FEC, I just donated $130,000 to keep my mistress's mouth shut so that I can win this election. Like that's democracy. But, you know, it's just really, it was an interesting argument to me that they were making. And I think they're trying to counter the narrative more directly than just on the elements.
100%. You know, I made a point earlier. I said they're hamstrung by their client. One issue that every criminal defense attorney has is that they ultimately are acting on behalf of their client. When you're a prosecutor, one thing when I was a federal prosecutor, my client was the United States of America, i.e. I do what I think is right. I'm trying to fight for justice, okay? It's a different situation than when you actually have a human being who's paying your bills and is telling you this is what, and you are required as a lawyer.
Or not paying your bills.
Or not paying your bills. But you're required by ethical rules to do only what your client is instructing you to do and authorizing you to do, as long as that's legal and so and ethical and so on. And so my point is, I think that they've been hamstrung here because they have to deny everything and fight everything. And I will say this. I'll make a bold statement here, which I'm sure will generate a lot of nasty YouTube comments, maybe threatening phone calls. If you, Asha, were the defendant here, not Donald Trump, somebody very sympathetic and who's not going to do crazy stuff in the courtroom, is going to actually stand for the jury and look very respectful and cry or be tearful or whatever. And I could just do whatever I wanted. You're like, we're not to just do carte blanche. I would have a good shot of either getting this knocked down to a misdemeanor or getting a hung jury or something like that. But a big part of the problem here is Donald Trump for the defense, because he's making him contest all this other stuff. I agree that that's silly. I mean, the point really should be they're not on trial for the hush money thing. Okay, the hush money thing happened. That's not what the case is about, ladies and gentlemen. You know, that is, whether you like it or not, that's actually legal. That's not what they're fight. That's not what this is about. This is about falsification of business records. And let me tell you something. This is how they could argue it. This guy, well, I think Blanche did. This guy was in the White House when that was happening. He's not paying attention to what's going on in some business record. He's not ordering to people, what's the evidence on that? That's their only real winner. That's their big winner in terms of actually trying to win on everything as opposed to just trying to knock it down to a misdemeanor.
Yeah, I do think that the vulnerability is in proving Trump's knowledge of the actual details of the concealment and the purpose for the concealment, and getting more of the direct link there. Though on that point, of course, yesterday he comes out of court and stands in front of the courtroom, a courthouse, and starts blabbing all kinds of things. And one of them, which I homed in on and I tweeted about, was, you know, he starts going on and on about how this was just a, you know, these were legal fees and people have lawyers all the time. They're, you know, this is a normal business expense. And then he says, we didn't even take a deduction for it. And to me, I'm like, well, that actually doesn't help you, my friend, because if it's a legitimate business expense, then why would you not take a deduction for it? Like, and why do you know that?
I agree with
you. Know
that.
What I'm saying? Like, why would you go out and like say,
I agree with
I don't
you
know.
On that.
I mean, like, I think he should have been like, I have no idea. Like, I don't manage the books or whatever. But to go in and like present, I guess, his defense in a way that I think undercuts.
I agree with everything you said. Defense. Okay. So I agree with that. So just so we're on the same page. First of all, I don't think he's likely going to win. Okay. I'm making this crystal clear. I think he's likely going to be defeated. That's just the case in every criminal trial. Okay. The defense is likely going to lose. Secondly, I think Donald Trump is tanking his own side. He's getting in his own way. And that's why I gave this caveat of you being the defendant. I don't realistically think that Donald Trump is going to help. He's hurting his side in the courtroom. If you're sleeping during the trial, if you're you know, sighing and making faces. I mean, the way he's been described, he's like making faces when stuff's going on in the trial. That's like, jurors do not like that stuff.
Yeah, Olivia Newsy said that he's making trout-like mouth movements.
I saw the same thing. I'm like, what are you doing, man?
Is he mocking the judge? Like, when the judge is talking, is he doing like the...
It may be. I mean, that's the sort of stuff that juries can hate, that stuff. There's just going to be jurors who just make up their mind like, this guy's an a-hole, and they just are going to decide like, we don't want to have anything to do with this guy. So you could just have a situation where like, you lose almost all the jurors like before any evidence gets on, or without even regard to the evidence. So yeah, I mean, this guy is tanking himself. I don't think his comments will end up hurting him, because it's a word salad containing a lot of positive things about himself. The prosecutors are going to want to goad him into taking the stand. Prediction, I don't think he does take the stand, because I think he would get destroyed given Mershon's ruling. That's another thing that happened. As to all of the impeachment that could be used against him, which is brutal. I mean, he could be confronted with the defamation of E. Jean Carroll and his violations of gag orders and all sorts of other things. Like, that guy's not going to take the stand. I mean, if he does, that's great. That's like a free win for the prosecution. I don't think that's going to happen. He didn't take the stand in the AG's case. He didn't testify in front of Mueller and so on.
Like, can they undermine his credibility by pointing out that he was impeached twice as president?
I don't think they asked to do that. I actually wouldn't if I were them, because I wouldn't want to focus on the fact that he's president. In that bubble. So one thing people have to understand, trials are a bubble. And a lot
you
of...
You want to normalize him as being any other defendant.
Correct.
As much as possible.
You want to like... A lot of weird stuff can happen inside that bubble. And your job as a lawyer is to sort of have a reality distortion lens and sort of present whatever is going on, whether you're the prosecutor or defense, but in this case, the prosecutor, in that bubble. And yeah, this guy's not the president. We're treating him like anyone else. This guy's Donald Trump, Mr. Trump. I'd address him as Mr. Trump.
I just wanted to say impeach him with his impeachment.
I get it. Well, oh, I see. Yeah, that's pretty good.
That it was ironic. I don't know. Yeah, so we don't think that he's going to take the stand. And then let's talk about David Pecker.
Yeah. So
just to kind of lay the scene, this is really important, right? Because as you said, the theory of the case is that these payments were concealed as a part of a conspiracy. And David Pecker is going to speak to the whole catch and kill scheme that they had. And as a part of this, there were other people who were paid off too. So this is kind of putting the Stormy Daniels payment into a larger pattern of suppressing negative stories about Trump. So that to me, I mean, I think that that is pretty straightforward for the jury and seems like it would be a very compelling piece. And I'm curious what you think about, is Pecker going to be a hostile witness because they're friends? And to what extent does this non-prosecution agreement that was in place for AMI, like how much leverage does the prosecution have over him to make sure that he throws Trump under the bus?
Wow, great questions. I mean, when you are trying a case, you're really, I view it like staging a play, putting on a play. And each of the witnesses are like an actor that you're using in your play. And you always want to start with a witness who sets the stage, so to speak, and gives the background that the jury is going to use to understand and fit everything else in. Because otherwise, if you don't do that well, then the jury is like confused. They're like, we have this case or we have this witness and this witness and this witness. How do they all fit together? It's all very disjointed. So between your opening statement and the first witness or two, you want to make sure you set the stage and help give them a framework under which they can insert all the other testimony and exhibits and have it all make sense. So Pecker is really important for that, because the background of the story is the hush money payments. Those aren't the, technically speaking, under New York law, the crime, but that's the centerpiece of what's going on. So it's a very important and smart first witness for them to call. And, you know, you raise an interesting point. How hostile is David Pecker going to be? And I think what's interesting about it is the way I would approach that if I was in the prosecution is I would only elicit from Pecker things that are like uncontroversial. for the most part. I bet that's what they are, because they don't need him. Nothing on the prosecution rises or conviction here rises or falls on what Pecker says for the most part. Pecker is going to be a background witness setting the stage.
Well, Pecker places Trump at the scene of making the agreement.
Correct.
I mean, Pecker is really important to establish that Trump had the intent and knowledge of the whole scheme. In other words, he wasn't just like, oh, I don't know who this, like, take care of it and, you know, off playing golf. Like, he was there having the conversation.
That's right. They have Trump on tape, though, with Cohen. Uh-huh. So I think if you're in the Trump team, you're not going to go hard at Pecker. And the reason that I say, my point is just going to be a friendly cross. And the reason I think that's one reason why he's going first. You do not want to have, if you're the prosecution, your first witness get trashed. Jurors pay attention to the first witness and the last witness. That has more impact in their mind. So you start solid, you end solid all the time. So Pecker's solid. They probably figure we're going to get what we get out of him. You know, he's fine. He's useful. He sets the stage. He's a good witness. He's helpful for us. He's not the most essential witness, but he's important, and he'll set the stage, and he won't get, you know, a devastating cross like Michael Cohen.
Yeah.
So one thing that I will say that I think people are, you know, before we turn to the gag order, which we'll do for the next segment here, one thing I think people are sleeping on is, particularly with two lawyers in the jury, the potential that Trump gets convicted on misdemeanors and not felonies. That is possible. It is possible that ultimately what happens is they find that Trump is guilty of falsifying business records, but they don't find that he concealed another. He was doing it for the purposes of concealing another offense. They find instead that he was doing it for the purposes of preventing bad press or something along those lines. That's possible with two lawyers and the jury. I don't think it's likely, but it'll be interesting to see, Asha, the extent to which mid-trial you start seeing, and then in particular in closing arguments, Trump's team focus more on these half measures, like, you know, half a loaf versus a full loaf. I mean, if I was on Trump's team, I would be encouraging them early on, like, let's focus on hung jury, misdemeanor, whatever, anything we can call a victory, because it's like in Manhattan against the DA in with this guy as our defendant, like, you know, we're going to have trouble winning this one.
One thing I'll just say about this, watching the coverage yesterday, is, you know, we underestimate, even though I know until now, many people, including you, thought this was sort of a minor case and maybe shouldn't have been brought. The coverage is laying out it's explaining all the witnesses. It's rehashing all of this stuff from 2016. And I'm just pointing that out from a political perspective, not really a legal one. I'm not really surprised that there was wall-to-wall coverage, but I've hadn't fully appreciated how much that starts to delve into, as you said, all these shady shenanigans from like 8 years ago. And I mean, I think far from whatever happens in terms of the outcome, I do think that having these details in the public's mind, and then if it's followed, especially by yet another trial, which is going to have the same wall-to-wall coverage of even more serious conduct, I don't think that is great for him, politically speaking.
You know, I'm not a political expert, but I have a very similar reaction. I mean, I don't think this is good for him. It's also just not good for his mentality and his psyche and what he's doing. I mean, I can't imagine. Like I said, not a political expert. Can't imagine, though, that you want your candidate like sitting in a Manhattan courtroom for 6 weeks in the middle of a presidential race. Doesn't seem like the best use of his time. I don't think this is a good thing for him. And if it's followed by a felony conviction, even if the sentencing isn't until after the election, that can't be good either. It's just, you know, you can explain it however you want or try to put some context on it, but the bottom line is the guy's convicted. So very challenging. And I mean, his legal team is in a very difficult position because, like I said, they're likely going to lose and the result's going to be bad for him. And he's going to probably blame them instead of taking responsibility himself.
When it comes to teaching kids and teens about money, practice makes perfect. That's where Greenlight comes in. With a debit card and money app of their own, kids learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Parents send instant money transfers, create custom chores, and automate allowance. while kids track their spending, set savings goals, and practice money skills they can use today and for life. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
Okay. So, gag me with a silver spoon, to use a phrase from the 80s. We have yet another gag order violation by Trump. I mean, we've talked about this before, and but I mean, it does feel like he's getting emboldened.
Well, he is. And, you know, one thing I will note is there's another example, by the way, of his lawyers being, screwed by him, is that, his lawyer had to argue to the judge that he was not violating the gag order. And Judge Merchan this morning said, "You've lost all credibility with this court." Basically, literally those words, which is a brutal thing for a lawyer to hear, because, you know, when you're up there, you know, he's in a situation too. You know, a lot of times your client asks you to defend the indefensible. Okay. And in those circumstances, if you're a public defender on a case that no one's going to pay attention to, United States versus Jane Doe, you're just like, "Look, judge, my client has asked me to take this position." And you use framing for it to make the judge understand that you're doing what your client asked you to do. But here in this case, he can't do that. And the defendant's sitting right there, and it's the case of a lifetime. And so he had to do what he had to sit there and tell the judge with a straight face, "Oh, no, you know, these statements do not violate a gag order." It's silly. But Trump is recognizing what I tried to say last week. It upset some of you, which is that the judge's not going to throw him in jail for these truths or posts or whatever they are. He's not going to do that. And so Trump's just like, "Screw it. I'll pay your fine. And I don't care if the judge hates me," because in his mind, the judge is against him anyway. So who cares?
So there's no limit in your view. I was hearing a lot of commentators yesterday suggesting that Merchan could go full nukes.
Well, and this is, we could talk about it some other time. But, you know, there's a lot of value, I suppose. I've found that the people who say stuff that people want to hear get retweeted more. I don't really think there's a universe in which Merchan throws Trump in jail in the middle of the trial. Maybe he does. I just don't see that for a number of reasons.
But one, what about suspending it till the end?
He could, right. He could say, "I'm going to hold this to the end. I'm going to hold deciding this issue to the end, and maybe I'll do it then." Maybe. But even then, he's got like an issue. He's got an issue here, because he's essentially trying to imprison this guy for speech about a public trial that's obviously of tremendous worldwide concern. And he's doing it for conduct that didn't even occur in his sight. It's just the sort of thing that's going to generate a challenge, and there's going to be very reputable First Amendment types that are going to defend Trump on this. And it's not at all an easy call for a court or a slam dunk. So I think Merchan has to try to find a way to put pressure on him. And the usual ways for any normal person is that they don't want to get sentenced by a judge who hates them. Mm-hmm. That's the ordinary thing, but this guy's not thinking that way.
Well, we saw that in the civil fraud trial.
Right.
I mean, that wasn't sentencing, but that was somebody who was doing a bench trial, who was basically judge and jury, and he violated gag orders there at least twice, I believe, and got fined.
Right. It did nothing. My point is, and this is why I'm just like with gag orders, like I just, maybe they work for in some circumstances. I don't think they work here. It didn't really help Judge Egeron. Trump attacked him anyways, disrespected him. And then what did the judge do? He went through the book at Trump. And that's what I think if Judge Mershon can do here or may do here is just when there's objections, when there's evidentiary rulings and there's requests for arguments. I mean, whether it's conscious or not, do you really think that perhaps maybe those rulings on the impeachment, the Santiago rulings on the impeachment, that could that have gone a different way potentially if the judge felt really good about Trump and, you know, how compliant he was with court orders? We will never know.
I mean, are you suggesting that it's not based on being objective and fair?
What I'm suggesting is that human beings and how they make decisions is complicated. I spend a big part of what I do for a living is persuading people of things. And I do not persuade people primarily through what's going on in their conscious mind. I do it, persuade people primarily through their unconscious biases and the unconscious things that they are thinking about and reacting to in the middle of a trial. And that includes it, by the way, or a court hearing, that includes a judge who in some ways is, you know, yes, they have a robe. Yes, they're a lawyer, but ultimately they're a human being. And so I do think that stuff matters. I do think there are there cases, like one question I've been asked is, would somebody else be in prison if they did this? It depends on the person. It depends on the context. I don't think that Trump's being treated differently than Elon Musk would be in this circumstance. Is he treated differently than somebody in Inglewood in the South Side of Chicago who has a public defender? Yes.
So this is kind of cart horsing the whole trial a little bit, but in terms of the sentencing is, because I always understood that this case was not, even if Trump were convicted on everything, would not realistically result in any jail time. But I think some of our colleagues have said that that's not the case. And I'm curious what your view is.
So I talked to a lot of alums of the Manhattan District Attorney's Office, people who mm-hmm. practiced at the office at high levels, and then people who are on the, you know, who are now on the other side and the defense side. And I got a range of responses. And I would say there was definitely a number of folks who I greatly respect who said there would be no prison time for John Doe in this circumstance with these type of offenses. First time offender. And yes, I understand he's been arrested elsewhere, but he's not been convicted elsewhere and he's presumed innocent. First time offender, you know, lowest class of felony, white collar defendant, unlikely to be imprisoned. I have had one person who told me that she believed that prison time, who was very credible and also very, you know, somebody who has a lot of experience, she thought Trump would get prison time because the judge would consider all of his other conduct, whether it had been convicted or not. And that would take, you know, his disrespect for the law and his bad activity elsewhere, which in many ways is much worse, right? January 6th than the documents case and so on. So the Mar-a-Lago case. So I don't know, but I think it's possible. It's certainly on the table that Mershon could throw him in prison after this. He certainly, Trump's making that more and more of a possibility every day. Let's put it that way.
And you think it's more likely that he would be willing to do that if he's actually convicted? Because it's not, even if there's a discretionary, right. Like.
Yeah, he's. It's one thing to sentence someone who's been convicted of a felony to a term of imprisonment when that's authorized by statute versus saying, I issued an order that you cannot speak about certain subjects, a prior restraint on speech. And in violation, because you violated that order, I am going to put you in jail. I just think that's like the sort of thing that you're going to get like First Amendment groups intervening on Trump's side.
Yeah,
like,
yeah,
why
yeah.
do? Why put yourself in that position if you're the judge? Doesn't make sense to me.
Okay. But we'll see.
We shall see.
Hey parents, Greenlight is here to take one big thing off your to-do list, teaching your kids about money. With a Greenlight debit card and money app of their own, kids and teens learn to earn, save, and invest. You can send money instantly, set flexible controls, and get real-time notifications of your kids' money activity, set up chores, and put allowance on autopilot to reward them for their hard work. Then learn about the world of money together. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
So, Asha, before we go, Taylor Swift's released another album. I have to say, I wish I was that prolific. I feel like I do a lot of things. I'm very busy, but it is insane the amount of music that she's able to pump out. When she was just entering an era of being somebody, we were more focused on her dating life than mm-hmm. we were on her music for a period of time.
Yeah. Are you a Swiftie?
I am not. I'm not an anti-Swiftie either. I think she's... I like the fact that she spoke her mind and took a risk to talk about, you know, her political views and her views about women and other things. I think that's really of value. Kudos to her for taking that risk. I think it's awesome that I think she's a good songwriter, and I think it's awesome that she has achieved so much. I'm very impressed by her. I also am impressed. I loved when she sued that guy for $1. The guy who harassed her and won $1 as a lawyer. I thought that was also badass that she did that to make a point. But I'm not like, I mean, her music's good. I like some of her songs, but I'm not like super into them.
Yeah, I kind of like I'm open to becoming a Swiftie. I actually have a few friends my age who are. But mostly I feel like I know a lot of people who their kids are. Their daughters are, and they're like, you know, their big graduation gift is to get their daughter Taylor Swift tickets in London. And I wish I were that mom, but my daughters, I don't know. Like, I feel like it's a club that I'm not a part of that I would be open to being a part of, but I'm not. And I'm not really sure how to do that except by just listening to the music. I agree with you on the political front. I think she's really badass, and I love that she speaks out. I love that she encourages people to vote. I love that, you know, in many ways, the backlash against it only elevates that piece of it. And I love that she has so many loyal, devoted followers that those exhortations will hopefully have some effect, you know, to go register to vote and to make their voice heard. So I think she's, from a pro-democracy standpoint, I admire her and support her, and so I would like to also support her work.
Yeah, I will say my wife is also wants to have that daughter that is super into Taylor Swift. Think that would be cool. My stepdaughter's not into Taylor Swift at all.
Yeah, me neither.
But my wife thinks she's awesome. I will say that I have really followed the whole romance with Travis. I think that's super cool. I like him, and you know, I think he's a great football player. I think him and his brother are funny. So I think that's really cool. I actually thought that we're really kind of going in that direction, like her and him and Jason and Jason's wife are all becoming kind of celebrities in their own right. And, you know, people have been really following that. They're kind of like the it couple right now. Right. Travis and Taylor, which is cool. But yeah, I want to be supportive of her, just like I'm supportive of other causes like the WNBA or something that I think are cool. But in both circumstances, you know, I probably am not, you know, I'm not as doing as much as I could. I suppose streaming a song here or there is not putting much money in Taylor Swift's pocket.
Maybe we should go to a concert together.
Well, that would be fun. We could do that as an It's Complicated event. Our views
could do that as an It's Complicated event.
That would be awesome.
We could record. Yeah, we could record a pod while we're, but don't they like sell out like immediately? I don't know. I have a friend who like buys them all over the place. And I'm like, she like stays up and she's ready the covers over her computer for when they're released. And I'm like, I've got 99 problems. And like trying to get Taylor Swift tickets is not one of them.
All right.
But if you were to be able to score them, I would
afford a ticket. I think
we can afford it. How much are they?
I don't know. But I'm sure they're not cheap. I think we can do it.
All right. Okay. I'm in.
All right.
MSW Media.
When it comes to teaching kids and teens about money, practice makes perfect. That's where Greenlight comes in. With a debit card and money app of their own, kids learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Parents send instant money transfers, create custom chores, and automate allowance, while kids track their spending, set savings goals, and practice money skills they can use today and for life. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.